Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is March 26, 2022, and I'm your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Float Away, Float Away, Float Away from Misinformation. And our guest skeptic is Professor Melanie Treacek-King. She is an associate professor at Massasoit Community College in Massachusetts, and she is the founder of the excellent website, Thinking is Power. Welcome to the SGM, Melanie.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so honored to be here.
Listen, the honor is mine because I found out about you through Twitter. Twitter can be amazing. And I saw all these excellent posts that you were putting up or tweets on critical thinking. And I'm like, you know what? I've got to get her on the SGM. But what got you so interested in this area of critical thinking?
Yeah, actually, that was an interesting route. I have been teaching at a community college for quite some time, and I taught the gen ed science classes, the ones for people who didn't want to be scientists when they grew up.
What's gen ed? I'm thinking like Generation X. Is that what we're talking about?
General education.
Ah.
So for all of the other majors outside of science, they have to take science as part of their liberal arts education. And often that class was what most of us call baby bio, which is where you take all of biology and then you distill it down into a semester and then you fly through all the major concepts and facts that we know about biology in a semester. And I kept thinking to myself, is this really the best way to do this? So I think I taught that course for probably 12, 13 years. I used half dozen books. No book. I used issues. So for example, instead of teaching just cell division, I would teach cancer. Or instead of just teaching about species and diversity, I would use the race concept and do humans meet the biological definition of races. So I was really trying to use current issues to teach students biology. But it just still seemed to me like a waste of time in that these things are all really useful and interesting. Don't get me wrong. I love biology. But the purpose of general education science is to instill scientific literacy, critical thinking. This is the last chance that we have to teach science to the vast majority of the population. And if I have a semester to teach basic science, is this what I want the students to learn? And so I went to the department and I said, why are we doing this? What is the purpose of general education science? And they agreed, science literacy, critical thinking. Okay, are the courses that we're offering meeting those goals? And I was lead instructor for intro bio at the time. I actually convinced them, to their credit, we removed intro bio off the books. And I made a course to replace it. And I called it Science for Life. And I used a backward design approach where I decided to, my goals were critical thinking, science literacy, information literacy. And how do I meet those goals? So I blew the whole thing up, started with the goals in mind, started from scratch.
So was this a science course that people had to take? Was this like the mandatory credit that they had to take in their undergraduate college degree, and everybody had to take a science course, and this is baby biology? This was their easy science credit that they had to get to check the box and get through. And you said, wait a minute, this is an opportunity to do more, to teach more, and to teach lifelong skills of critical thinking and skepticism.
Exactly.
Well, through our online interactions, it became very clear to me that we had something in common. We're Feynman fans. There's so many quotes, and I always hate asking people this kind of question, like, what's your favorite? So maybe you can just give me one of your favorites, and I'll make it easier for you. I'll give you one of my favorite Feynman quotes, and then maybe you can give one of yours. So one of my favorite Feynman quotes is, we need to teach how doubt is not to be feared, but welcomed. And it's okay to say, I don't know. And I say, I don't know a lot of times because I don't know everything. And there's lots of things I don't know. And by not knowing things inspires me to want to know more and to continue on this lifelong journey of learning. What's your favorite Feynman quote, or one of them?
Yeah, I just have to say that quote is amazing. And we don't use that phrase enough. I don't know. And we don't model it for our students enough. When I say I don't know to my students, sometimes they look at me like, whoa, wait, I have never heard a professor say I don't know before. My favorite is probably the first principle is that you must not fool yourself. And you are the easiest person to fool.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I've been fooled many times by myself over the years, and trying to come up with critical thinking skills and an approach to try to insulate that from happening over and over again and minimize the times that you will fool yourself.
Yeah, I actually start the semester by fooling my students because I could tell them I could fool them, but I don't think they'd really believe me. And so I fool them to prove to them I can fool them. And through the process of getting them to be a bit more humble, of recognizing their own limits, of recognizing how we can be fooled, that's how you build a justification for science. If we can figure everything out through our own experiences, why do we even need science to begin with?
Yeah, makes sense. I'd love to be a student on your first day and experience being fooled by you. You're not going to spill the beans here, so because you know some of your future students may be listening. So we don't want to tell them how you're going to trick them or fool them. But out of this, you created a really good website called Thinking is Power. Is that where Thinking is Power came from these lectures that you were putting together for this course? Or tell us a little bit more about this website that you put together.
So I started teaching the class, and when I put together the course, I couldn't find a book that I wanted students to buy. Textbooks are so expensive, first of all. But nobody had really put together anything that fit my needs. The closest I came, and I actually recommend to students to buy Novella's.
Yeah, yeah, The Skeptic's Guide. Dr. Novella was on our program when that book came out. It's an excellent resource for skeptics.
Indeed it is. Yeah. So I recommend that one. But so that I use a variety of online resources, readings, videos, etc. But I wanted to provide students with an online resource that was specific for the class. So I started writing content and putting it online, and it sort of morphed into, I had a few goals for the website. One was for my students. One was for other educators, because I'm a huge fan of this approach now of using skills, teaching skills as opposed to teaching facts. And so I hope to provide resources for other educators who are interested. And then I just had this crazy idea that maybe people would just be interested in learning about critical thinking. And I am thrilled to know that they are. One of the quotes actually that inspired the course was great book, Schick and Vaughn, How to Think About Weird Things. And they said, the quality of your life is determined by the quality of your decisions. And the quality of your decisions is determined by the quality of your thinking. And I kept thinking, I want to empower my students, and knowledge changes all the time, and students carry in their pockets access to basically all of humanity's knowledge. The question is, can they think through that? Can they use critical thinking to make better decisions? So instead of knowledge is power, I decided I wanted to promote thinking is power. And so the idea was basically to the general public then, could I provide a resource where the critical thinking education was interesting enough that the average person might want to learn? So I use things like approachable language as opposed to, there's a really great critical thinking resources out there and skeptic web resources. But I wanted to provide it to a more general audience. So I use stories. I use shareable graphics for social media to get people's attention, to try and cast as wide of a net as I can and see if people would be interested in learning.
Well, you mentioned a couple of things there I just want to touch upon. One is that you're telling stories, and a narrative is so important. And we see this in lots of communication where somebody tells a story that connects with people, and it allows them to understand so much more than just giving them a list of bullet points and facts, but giving them some narrative to latch onto and remember. The other thing that you mentioned was about graphics, I think you said, and this lets me point out, I really like your Thinking in Power logo. You've got this brain, it's smiling, it's giving you a wink, it's got a sweatband on because obviously it's working out, you know, because learning, you know, takes effort. And there it is, you know, working on a dumbbell to be smarter. Is this like excellent, excellent logo?
Thank you. I love my logo. I call them TIP. Thinking is Power, right? So TIP is their name. And it was designed by Wendy Cook, who is a great friend, Wendy and John Cook. And she's a graphic designer. And yeah, the idea is we all think. And so we all assume we're good at it. But good thinking is hard work. And you have to learn how to do it. If you put it on autopilot, you're probably going to lead yourself astray. And so even the logo itself is fun. I mean, critical thinking and skepticism doesn't have to be so serious and such a downer all the time. It can be fun and empowering.
Oh, you've heard the goofiness of the S-gem, haven't you? It reminds me of one of my favorite quotes by Marshall McLuhan. And he said, anyone who tries to make a distinction between education and entertainment doesn't know the first thing about either. Oh, yes. You've got to find that sweet spot. You can't all be just facts and lists and bullet points. And you can't all be goofiness and no content. You've got to find that Goldilocks zone of really interesting and engaging and really important content. And that's where the magic happens. Oh, there be gold.
My students have taught me so much over the years. I mean, I teach at a community college in an urban area, and I have such diversity of students. They are what I view as the average American. And they have taught me what the average person knows, what they need to know, how to communicate so that they'll hear me, how to tell a story so that it resonates with them. And so that's what I've tried to do with the new course and with Thinking is Power.
Well, that's great. You brought up diversity because that's a nice segue into one of the questions I wanted to ask you about, because we've talked about gender equity like multiple times on the S-gem, and you mentioned on social media at one point that in the beginning of this project that you had, Thinking is Power, that you kept your gender sort of hidden or neutral or didn't identify as a woman. Can you explain why you took this action at the beginning?
So Thinking is Power, I've been on social media since May of 2020. So that's not very long, but for approximately the first year or so, I did not attach the website to who I was. So I was not out with who was behind it. And I did that because I was partly afraid of gender-based harassment. I saw others in this space suffer from gender-based harassment, and it was something that I personally wasn't prepared to deal with. And I also wanted to be taken seriously. And I felt that I maybe, and I don't know if this perception is accurate, but I felt that if I was out as a female, that maybe males in particular wouldn't take me as seriously. My name is now attached to it, but it's fascinating how many people still assume that I'm male. That said, so at this point, I just discovered this. My Facebook page is at nearly 18,000 followers. And my gender distribution is about 51% male and 48% female. So my approach, I feel, is working, not necessarily hiding my gender identity, but trying to make the content and the approach relatively gender neutral.
This might come out the wrong way, but I really don't care about your gender or how you identify. But I do care, obviously, like it's important to you, but I really don't, it doesn't matter. Your content is so great and I think you're amazing and it doesn't matter, you know, male, female, non-binary, I don't care. I don't care. Your content is amazing. And so please keep doing what you're doing on social media. We need voices like you out there.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. And I've appreciated your support on social media.
This is not another gender equity episode, but rather an S-Gem extra to discuss this article that you put out called, quote, "A Life Preserver for Staying Afloat in a Sea of Misinformation." And it was published in the March-April 2022 edition of Skeptical Inquirer magazine. So that's why we're doing it this time. and it discussed something called Floater. How did this opportunity come up?
So actually, my first article in Skeptical Inquirer was in the January-February issue, and it was Teach Skills, Not Facts. That article came about because Guy Harrison, who's a regular columnist for Skeptical Inquirer, had published something called How to Repair the American Mind, Solving America's Cognitive Crisis. And it was basically a call for critical thinking education. And so I contacted him on Twitter and I said, I have this course and I had an article on my website about my course. And he said it was a great article and that I should contact Skeptical Inquirer. So I did. And that was my first article that I had published. And after that, the article itself referenced a toolkit that I give students to evaluate claims. And it's really important to give students a toolkit. And we can talk about that later. But the toolkit was a bit old, wonderful toolkit. But in my mind, I had played around with how to update it. So I updated it and sent it back to Skeptical Inquirer and said, is this something that you would be interested in? And they said yes. So I suppose the rest is history.
And here we are. Well, I will include a link to the Life Preserver article, obviously, but also your previous article from earlier in the year for people to read. I have to tell you, though, when I saw the acronym FLOATER, my mind, as a physician, of course, went to the medical condition of having floaters in patients' visual fields. However, I understand some people had another initial take on what floater meant.
Yeah, as did I might add, because I have like junior high level sense of humor. But so when I teach critical thinking and science literacy, it's kind of a bear, like it's difficult to start. Like if I give my students a claim and say, evaluate this claim, use critical thinking. Oh, great. Where do I start? So what I wanted to do was give them a toolkit, and I had filters and it's great, but I wanted to make a toolkit that summarized and organized the concepts of critical thinking and scientific reasoning. So I was playing around with rules and with different concepts, and all roads kept leading back to floater. And I will admit, in my mind too, I kept thinking of floater like a turd in a toilet.
You giggled. Come on, you giggled.
I totally giggled. Yeah, giggled. And to be fair, everyone I ran this by also giggled because that was the initial thing that came to everyone's mind. And you know, it took a while, but finally it occurred to me that, wait a minute, this also means a life preserver. And that's what I'm trying to do. So a good acronym is memorable. And this is memorable. However you decide to remember it, floater is memorable. But it also describes what it is that it's covering. And in this case, it is saving yourself from misinformation. It's a flotation device. It's a life preserver. So that's how floater came to be.
So it's not something that floats up to the top that you can't ignore and that you can't just flush away this information. You have to recognize it.
You have to recognize it.
Now, there other people had come up with other thoughts on floaters after the initial giggle. I, of course, have watched a lot of crime TV shows over the years. So the other thing that came to mind was, oh, we got a floater, as in a police officer will point towards the river and say a body had floated up. But you had mentioned some other people had talked about a sports analogy to floater.
Yeah, I have never thought of the dead body. I think I'm glad that I never thought of it. My husband's a huge sports fan, so a floater, like in basketball, is, I'm not even going to try, but a basketball that floats up and goes in.
It's okay. This is an audio program. You don't have to show us how that happens. As she's trying to demonstrate what a floater is.
Thing.
As a whoosh over and, you know. It'll be interesting. I'm going to challenge the SGEM audience. After the first thing that comes to your mind, what's the second thing that comes to your mind when you think floater? But let's get into floater. So it's an acronym. It grew out of somebody else's work called James Lett's Field Guide to Critical Thinking that published, I don't know, decades ago. And in this, he summarized the scientific method with an acronym called FLITCHERS. Is that right? Was it called Flitchers? Because it doesn't really roll off the tongue like, well, I don't want floaters rolling off the tongue, but it doesn't roll off the tongue like floater.
Flitchers, yeah. So he published his Field Guide to Critical Thinking in 1990 in Skeptical Inquirer. And I had been using it. And so it stands for the vowels don't stand for anything. It's falsifiability, logic, comprehensiveness, honesty, reproducibility, and sufficiency. And I contacted James and said, you know, I've been toying around with updating this acronym. Here's my really old moment. So my students, this toolkit was published in 1990. Most of my students are born after the millennium.
Or after the best decade ever, the 1980s.
Exactly.
So they have no clue about the wonderful art in the cinema and on radio or tapes and CDs that are the 80s.
They miss all the best cultural references that I brought my class.
Well, do you know that I give a USB key to the residents that train with me after their first shift, and I identify their educational needs based on which jokes they didn't get from the 1980s, and I put five movies from the 1980s, and I individualize it to the student, of course, because they all have different needs, but there are some core content knowledge from the 1980s movies. So I give them a little USB key, and since it's an audio program, and nobody can see this, I will pull out the audio key that I give. What do you see?
Of course, it's a little Batman.
Yes, a little Batman USB key I've got now to give to them with five 80s movies on them so that they can understand my cultural references and jokes in the emergency department. And it's become a two-way street because obviously I don't know all the latest, you know, social stuff. And they share their references with me because I mispronounce things quite often, as the SJMers know. And so they'll go, well, Dr. Milne, it's Leviosa, not Leviosa, or something like that from Harry Potter. And so now I understand, you know, when they say that to me, I'm mispronouncing something.
Oh, I have so many questions. What movie appears the most on the?
Oh, I know. Most people have that. What are the five movies? Ken, tell me what the five movies are. I mean, these are core content movies. These are Ferris Bueller's Day Off. These are Dirty Dancing, Breakfast Club, Top Gun, of course. Oh, by the way, I'm having a big Top Gun party in 2 months. And Terminator 2. Oh, I could just go on and on.
Oh.
Goonies. There's just so many movies from the 1980s.
Princess Bride.
Princess Bride. Inconceivable. Yes, of course, Princess Bride's on there often. They're only mostly dead. Yeah, that comes up in the emergency department. Anyways, come on, we're getting off topic here. Let's just float back to this other issue we were talking about.
Yeah, okay, so where are we? Oh.
Filters.
So I contacted James and I said, can I, what are your thoughts on maybe teaming up and updating the toolkit? And he said, I think it's a great idea, but you know, I think he's happily retired in France and more power to him. I'm kind of jealous.
So he's like, you go for it. You.
That was basically how it went. So, so I went at it. And I kept thinking, so I wanted to update references because again, these references are over a decade before my students were even born. He also focused primarily on the paranormal. And I wanted to bring in things like alternative medicine and various forms of denial that we see today, like GMO denial. And I found myself in class trying to use a lot of acronyms for different things. Like I had an acronym for the characteristics of science. And I had this filters. And I thought, well, I can put those together and I can make like one acronym to rule them all.
Oh, see, I got that reference. Yes. Thank you. Well, you know, when I was reading your article and it's a wonderful article, everybody should take the time. I really encourage them to read the article, but there was this one part where you said the foundation of floater is skepticism. And I'm like, oh, yes, I absolutely love that part of your article.
Yeah. I mean, if you don't, so skepticism gets a really bad rap, right? Skepticism is not denial or cynicism. It's just proportioning our beliefs to the evidence. And that's what we're trying to do. But it's also that part of your brain that you turn on and go, wait, does that make sense? I don't know. Is that true? And if you don't turn that on and check, then the toolkit is useless. You won't use the toolkit if you don't actually activate skepticism. And so skepticism and making sure that you clearly define the claim in any terms, and then the person making the claim bears the burden of proof. So if somebody has made the claim to you, it's not up to you to disprove, right? You're evaluating the claim as they have presented it. But it's really important to turn on the skepticism like radar inside of your head and check, just stop and check.
Yeah. And that burden of proof is very, very important, because often we'll get people saying, you know, you have to prove me wrong or prove a negative, which, you know, proving a negative is possible. It's a lot more difficult, of course, but it is possible. But those making the claim actually have the burden of proof. And when you say, I'm not convinced, doesn't mean you're claiming that it's not true. You're just saying, hey, I haven't accepted your claim, so I'm going to accept the null hypothesis. It's simple like that, but it's an important distinction to make with regards to the burden of proof. Very, very important. But let's go through this FLOTER acronym and discuss each one of them. Now, you didn't have the vowels knocked out of this. The vowels mean something. So, you know, when you go through FLOATER, it's the consonants and the vowels. So F, you know, you've got falsifiability, then logic, objectivity, alternative explanations, and then tentative conclusions, evidence, and reproducibility. So let's go through each one of those individually. Now, you do list these in your article, The Skeptical Inquirer, as, quote, rules. And people who listen to my show know that I have problems with rules. It's just tempting me to break them. You know, when I hear these clinical decision rules, it's clinical decision instruments and clinical decision tools. So, friendly amendment, take it as you will. Could you consider calling them tools?
I think that is a worthy amendment. Yes. Yes. And I like the positive spin to it.
Yeah. You know, and again, this gets back to skepticism has such a negativity to it in some aspects, you know, that it's denialism or nihilism, and it's not. It's healthy skepticism. It's scientific skepticism. And I like to think of it as positive skepticism. I mean, we're having this wonderful conversation. There's nothing negative about it. And we're talking about skepticism. So let's be positive skeptics and not sort of wag our finger and talk about rules and thou shalt and talk about, hey, here's some tools that could keep you afloat in a sea of misinformation. Tool number one, falsifiability. It must be possible to think of evidence that would prove the claim false. It seems counterintuitive, but the first step is determining if a claim is true, is to determine if you can prove it wrong. Please explain.
This is one of those concepts that I find my students really struggle with, and yet I think it's one of the most important concepts in critical thinking and science. So with the idea of falsifiability, what we're trying to do is figure out if the claim itself can be proven wrong. So students confuse falsifiability with false. I mean, if a claim has been shown to be false, then by definition, it was a falsifiable claim. And so what I've done here is try to organize the ways that violate this tool. So, for example, the ways that claims can be unfalsifiable are if they are subjective, if they are supernatural, if they are vague, or if they are ad hoc excuses. So, for example, an opinion is never falsifiable. You cannot, if I say, for example, that cats make the best pets, like I'm right.
Of course, you know, you're right, but I would push back a bit and say, well, I'm not going to invalidate your personal experience with pets and cats, but I'm a dog person, Melanie.
Ah, Yeah. So something also my students know about me is that if I can use cats as an example, I'm always going to, because I am.
Yes. I've seen some cat pictures. Of course, people who follow me on Twitter have seen my, our new dog, Loki, the dog of mischief. And she is living up to her name.
That is the best name. That is the best name. Ours is Dmitri Shostakovich, because my husband's like,
that's a composer, isn't it?
Yeah, because my husband's a conductor. So, yes. Dmitri Shostakovich. Yeah. So anyway, I could give you reasons why cats make the best pets, but that's an opinion. It can't ever be proven wrong. So the evidence that I have for that claim doesn't really matter, because that claim can't ever be shown to not be true.
So it's not falsifiable.
It's not falsifiable. Supernatural is a great example. So one of the ways God, spirits, ghosts, one of the ways this shows up in alternative medicine a lot recently is with energy medicine. In science, energy has a definition.
Yes.
And it is measurable and it is repeatable. But when somebody talks about energy medicine, it's this vague sort of supernatural force. It's not something that can be measured. And so it's not something that can be falsified. So this would be something that's undefined. Horoscopes are a great example. You know, if I say, like, you're going to have a great day today, right? Or a lot of supplements make vague claims because they have to. By law, they're not allowed to make specific health claims. So they'll say something like, reduces fatigue and supports overall immune health.
Yeah, it's supports or, supporting something like that, as opposed to something much more specific and demonstrable and falsifiable.
Right. So the problem with that is a lot of consumers will read that. And its vagueness seems like it's super duper fantastic, because it's like this broad, amazing claim, as opposed to recognizing the fact that it didn't really say anything. Or ad hoc excuses. So this is the avoiding falsifiability by making excuses. And the best example of this is probably conspiracy theorists. Conspiracy theorists are always able to find a reason for why the evidence doesn't support their conspiracy.
It's all part of the conspiracy, obviously.
Obviously. So when considering a claim, the first step is to figure out, is this a falsifiable claim? If somebody is not making a falsifiable claim, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's not true, but it does mean that you should view it with some skepticism and some caution. Because when they provide evidence for the claim, that evidence doesn't necessarily mean anything, because you can't ever demonstrate evidence against the claim.
You know, I don't want to get too much into sort of supernatural spirits or religion, but the term supernatural means it's outside of nature, and science can only examine nature. And the scientific method is the best method we have found to explore this natural world we live in and find the best point estimate of an observed effect size with a confidence interval around that point estimate. And it's not able to explore the supernatural because it's outside of nature, unless, of course, it interacts with nature. And then, of course, it contradicts its actual term. Then it's not supernatural if it's interacting with nature. But this whole idea of falsifiability gets back to, you know, Karl Popper, 100 years ago or so, saying, if it's not falsifiable, it's not really science. So that was his philosophy. And I'll put one of my favorite Karl Popper's quotes in the blog. It's time for tool number two, and this is about logic. I like this one. Arguments for the claim must be logical and not commit logical fallacies. So you describe two different types of arguments, deductive and inductive. Can you briefly explain these two types of arguments?
Deductive arguments provide conclusive support for a conclusion, whereas inductive arguments provide probable support. Most of the time, we make arguments that are inductive. But the problem is, we're really sure we're right, so we think they're deductive arguments. So part of this is recognizing the type of argument that we're making and the confidence that we can have in our conclusion.
Yeah, I see a lot of inductive arguments made in medicine as people are trying to explain or support a certain position. And these inductive arguments, they do have much more uncertainty around it. And I don't think people recognize that. And they think, nope, I've made this great argument. It must be true. I'm uncertain with that inductive argument. But, you know, we've been living through this COVID situation for the last couple of years. And I've seen a number of logical fallacies put through to support various COVID treatments. Things like an appeal to emotion. Oh, this is a global pandemic. People are dying. We have to use this certain medication or treatment. Or, oh, this is a very old-fashioned drug that's been repurposed. It must work. Or this is natural. And of course, a natural substance is going to be effective and stuff like that. How do you describe logical fallacies to your students so they get their head around this concept of, listen, you need to make a logical argument and not commit logical fallacies?
The whole concept of logic is really challenging for students. It's not something apparently that we teach in schools. And so when I get to fallacies, so fallacies are errors in reasoning, and there's like a gazillion fallacies. And so there's no possible way to cover them all. And part of the problem is with fallacies too, is that there are so many like groups of fallacies and sub fallacies. And of course, each fallacy name has a trillion different names, because why would we make it easy?
And there's two broad categories. There are the formal fallacies, right? But usually when we're talking about logical fallacies, especially on social media, they're not formal fallacies that people are committing. They're these informal fallacies, which, you know, each one can have different names. Like the appeal to tradition can also be an appeal to nature. There's a lot of crossover, and it's language dependent.
Yeah. So what I've done is tried to take the most commonly committed fallacies and teach students how to recognize those. Like, for example, ad hominem is very common. Ad hominem is an attack on the person. And so, there's a lot of attacks on, for example, Dr. Fauci, or calling scientists shills. And while calling a scientist a shill does not negate the argument that they're making, you're attacking the person. You're not countering their argument. The appeal to nature is very common. The idea that if something is natural, it must be safer, or it must be more effective, or something.
Must be good for you. Yeah, the one I use is dog poop's natural. I don't take that three times a day.
Exactly. I mean, arsenic is natural, right?
Uranium-235.
Poison ivy.
Got any cyanide?
Anthony and I, my husband and I joke, we're out in the woods. Like if he takes me off for a day, I can teach him what plants to eat or not to eat. Just be really nice for me today. Science is more of a way of trying to keep nature from killing us, if anything.
Yeah, nature is indifferent to us. It's a cold, uncaring universe.
But yet you walk through, I'm going to not name any supermarket chains, but you walk through some of the aisles and it's just an appeal to nature fallacy. All natural comes from nature. Nature's wisdom.
Marketing.
Yes. So, the wisdom of the ages and, ancient healing practices, etc. I mean, all of these are ways to convince us of something without actually using evidence. If I might take a tangent.
Melanie, you are the guest. I'm enjoying every moment of this. Tangent on.
Okay. So one of the techniques that I use in class that I think is really effective is called inoculation theory. So inoculation theory is based on the idea of vaccines, where...
Oh no, you're going down the vaccine route. And is this because I'm wearing my favorite t-shirt today just for this interview that says vaccines cause adults?
Oh, indeed. Yes. So it borrows from that. The idea that but it's for misinformation. So if we expose people to bits of misinformation, then in the real world, they are inoculated against that misinformation. And there's various ways to inoculate against misinformation. You can use fact-based inoculation, or you can use logic-based logic-based inoculation. So with logic-based inoculation, you could explain the logical errors behind an argument. So in this idea of logic, then explaining how the appeal to nature is a logical fallacy, and so that they can apply then this being inoculated against this particular fallacy to other things when they see it. I'm also a fan of what's called active inoculation, where they create misinformation. So I will have students, for example, make an advertisement for a pseudoscientific health product, like pick a supplement that does, and I give them different categories, like, for example, losing weight or building muscle or something like that, and design an advertisement using various logical errors. So, for example, they're going to have to tell me that it's all natural, that it comes from a plant from the Amazon that's natural and organic and GMO-free, and that the indigenous population there has been using it for thousands of years, and that Big Pharma wants to keep it hidden from us because they want to make money. And that, so by using these various logical errors in a process of creating misinformation, they can recognize those logical errors in the real world.
Nice. I like that. I'd love to see you post some of these ads or some of these things that your students have come up with, because you said you have quite a diverse group of students. I'm sure it's quite interesting, and to share those, if they would allow that, to share those on Twitter or on your website there. I think that would be really interesting. Have you thought about sharing them?
You know, I haven't, but students can be very creative. And so actually the assignment's coming up, I think, next week. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, see if you can get permission from them to whatever's created. Maybe have them vote on who they think came up with the top three out of the group, and then post those on social media. Give them a shout out.
Love it.
All right, time for tool number three. And this is about objectivity. The evidence for a claim must be evaluated honestly.
Yeah. I mean, if I'm being real, this is the hardest role. It is the hardest tool, because if anyone's going to deceive us, it's us. No one can deceive us like we can. And so with objectivity, what we need to do when evaluating a claim is make sure that we are being honest with ourselves, with what we want to be true, with our own reasoning. It's basically a metacognitive skill. You know, recognizing our own motivated reasoning and how confirmation bias can lead us to an incorrect conclusion. And the other biggie is overconfidence. So these big three, like motivated reasoning, confirmation bias, and overconfidence, can really lead us to a conclusion where we're not only wrong, but we're really confident that we're wrong. And it was all because we had in our mind what we wanted to be true based on an identity need or a social identity need. And it drove us to that conclusion. So recognizing our own reasoning and stepping in, being able to correct for our own reasoning flaws.
I don't know if you've noticed a dichotomization of this sort of area, where you have people who don't have a lot of information or knowledge can be quite sure of themselves and sure of their positions. But I interact with a lot of really, really smart people in my world. And I've found that these really, really smart people are also really, really good at rationalizing their positions because they're so smart. And they're pretty confident. You know, they express a lot of confidence about their position. I've learned through this journey some humility, and, you know, it gets back to, you know, your favorite Feynman quote about the first principle is you must not fool yourself and you're the easiest person to fool. But also one of my favorite quotes, and that is about doubt, and it's okay to say, I don't know. And, you know, more and more I'm saying, you know, I don't know, and I'm not sure, and I have uncertainty, and I'm not convinced. Have you noticed that there is this dichotomization where people with a little bit of knowledge are quite sure of their positions, and people with a lot of knowledge in maybe some other area are quite confident or are able to rationalize their positions because they are so smart.
Yeah, actually, I wish I could name the author. I think it might be Dan Kahan. Has this great, he calls it motivated identity cognition, if I'm getting that correctly. And he did this really interesting study on climate change and actually found that the more scientific knowledge Democrats and Republicans had, when Democrats were more scientifically knowledgeable, they became more concerned about climate change. And when Republicans were more knowledgeable about science, they became less concerned about climate change. So scientific knowledge was not actually protective. Because when people are smarter, more educated, better at reasoning, they are better able to justify the positions that they want to hold.
Mm.
And so he actually found what might be protective against that is scientific curiosity and not necessarily scientific knowledge. So it might be an interesting lesson for those of us science educators. But yeah, the smarter we are, you know, we just get better at justifying what we want to believe. And so, and then we get really proud of ourselves because of course we're really smart and we have all these really great reasons, right?
Yeah. And so we have to have some humility and recognize our own biases, our motivated thinking, and take a step back and go, really, am I being objective here? Am I honestly evaluating the claim, or am I motivated by other factors or some other biases are creeping in, either consciously or unconsciously? Let's get on to tool number 4. And this is having alternative explanations. Other ways of explaining the observation must be considered.
Yeah, Carl Sagan called these multiple working hypotheses, and we haven't dropped Sagan's name today, so I kind of feel like we should.
Oh yeah, we're both Sagan fans
too. Totally. So the idea is that, so you have an observation and you've explained it, and usually your explanation, the one that you've jumped to, is based on your system one thinking, your biases, the heuristics that your brain is taking based on all of that stuff that you've got going on in your head that might lead you astray. It could be right. Maybe it's not. Point is, check yourself with how else could I explain this? So propose other explanations. Think of as many ways as you might explain it, falsifiable, of course. Try to disprove them. And then with what's left, you know, a great tool might be Occam's razor. So you might appreciate this example, being a physician. So last year, I had a knee issue, and I went to the doctor, and they took an x-ray, and they found, ooh, a floating object.
They found a floater in your knee?
They found a floater in my knee. Obviously, this needs to come out. And as we were talking, I said, you know, I've actually had issues with both of my knees, similar problems. So he took an x-ray of the other knee and found another one. And so we couldn't figure out why both knees would have this a similar floating object. I went for an MRI. The MRI found one in the one knee, but not one in the other knee. And again, couldn't figure out why. And so, you know, I said, well, my mom has had knee problems. Maybe it's a genetic thing. Mom, that doesn't really sound like it's probably genetic. It's not like a common thing. So we were trying to propose explanations for this and nothing was really sufficient. So I went for surgery and the surgery was going to remove the floating objects from both knees. Got it from the one knee. The other knee went in and there's no floating object. Turns out, looking at the same x-ray, but for both knees. So you read the x-ray wrong.
Wow.
We both failed to consider that as an alternative explanation. And our inability to propose that alternative explanation left us without a sufficient way to explain it. And it was the correct one. And we missed it.
Great story. Great story. Yeah. You've got to find alternative explanations, or at least you don't have to find them, but just consider them. In medicine, we would consider this a differential diagnosis. So you don't make an anchoring error. You don't have the availability heuristic. It's like the thing that's right there. So you latch onto it and you ignore other information that confirms an alternative diagnosis, not disproves, but suggests that this isn't the diagnosis. To have a broad differential diagnosis when you're going in to explain something medically, and then you narrow it down. So having alternative explanations or a differential diagnosis is, it's one of the key parts of medicine. Tool number five, my favorite number, by the way, tentative conclusions. In science, any conclusion can be changed based on new evidence.
I personally think that this is one of the biggest misconceptions about science, is that science is based on proof. Like, I see it on social media all the time, and I see it in my students. Like, when science has proven something, I'll believe it. And they think science is certain. And science is a process of reducing uncertainty. It's not about achieving certainty. And so with tentative conclusions, what this tool is trying to say is you want to leave yourself open to changing your mind with new evidence. So theories are a great example. In science, when we get as certain as we possibly can get about a conclusion, about an explanation, we call it a theory. But, you know, in everyday language, that means, I don't know, it's a guess, right? But in science, it's actually really special. It means this is as sure as we're going to get, but we could change our mind. And I think a lot of people hear that and they think, well, scientists are so wishy-washy. They're always changing their minds. Why wouldn't they just like be certain and tell us what we know for sure and is proven? And so this is really getting to a fundamental characteristic of science, of we're never going to be certain. What can we conclude based on what we currently have, the evidence that we have, and we can change our mind?
Yeah, there's a great meme with Captain Jean-Luc Picard. And of course, I'm a Star Trek fan, more of the original series than next gen, but okay. And it's like, there's Picard reaching out and, you know, how is science proven wrong? By more science, right? And we update our positions. And so, of course, I've got to circle back to Feynman, though, who said, I have approximate answers and possible beliefs and different degrees of certainty about different things, but I'm not absolutely sure of anything. End of quote. And we've seen this in COVID as, you know, we have a novel coronavirus, so we don't have a lot of information. And so you have some hypotheses, you have some ideas about what's going on and what may work as a treatment, what may work as a preventative strategy, you know, whether it be masks, washing our hands, physically distancing, all of these types of things came in. And then all these medicines and therapies that were tried at the beginning, we didn't have a lot of information. But as we got more information, we should have a closer idea of what the quote unquote truth is. And that's the best point estimate of an observed effect size with a confidence interval around that effect. But we do have the ability as science, it's baked into it, that we change our positions based on, and we should. It shouldn't be doubling down. And we've seen this with some scientists and physicians and leaders, that when presented with information that doesn't confirm their originally held position, they dig their heels in more and they double down, as opposed to positive skeptical approach would be, hey, that's interesting. Now I'm going to change my position because I've been presented with convincing evidence. Okay, I don't personally identify with my position. My position is external to who I am as a person. And so it's not so threatening to me to say, hey, you know what? This is what I thought originally. I didn't have this information when I made that conclusion. Now I have new information. I'm going to modify and update my position. And my conclusion at this time is tentative, like most, if not all, of my positions.
I think most people are used to thinking about knowledge like it's dichotomous. We know or we don't know. And instead, yes, I talk with me. So instead, think of it as a spectrum. And I actually do an exercise with my students where it's a grayscale from 0 to 100. And when we're talking about a belief, put yourself somewhere on that scale. Avoid 100%. And it's more like Bayesian reasoning, like moving yourself around that scale based on what you currently know. And learn to be comfortable with uncertainty. I think that's one of the most important skills with critical thinking, is learning to be comfortable with not knowing. And back to objectivity for a second, because separating your belief from you, you are not your belief. Like, my acceptance of various scientific conclusions is not who I am. Those are outside of me. So if I separate my identity, myself, from those beliefs or from those conclusions, then I can more objectively evaluate them without it being so personal, without having to defend myself.
Yeah, it doesn't become such a loss or a threat to who you are when demonstrated that your position wasn't correct or wasn't as correct as you thought it was, because it does take place on a spectrum. And I'm going to bring this back to emergency medicine. We have a lot of clinicians that work in the emergency department or the pre-hospital care or the inpatient critical care service. We deal with uncertainty all the time, and maybe that's why we're more comfortable with it. You know, for 25 years, I've been working in an emergency department. Do I have all the information on the patient in front of me when I have to make a critical decision? No, I don't know everything. And I may not know everything about that person that's important for that decision at the time the decision is made. And so it's on a grayscale. It's on a probability. It's on a likelihood sort of thing. And so I make decisions every day, every shift, often with almost every patient, based on limited information, and yet I can still move forward. People sometimes look at, you know, sort of skepticism and critical thinking that you'll be paralyzed by indecision. And it's like, no, I still have to make a decision. And on that grayscale, am I convinced or not convinced is dichotomous. Once you're convinced, you're going, okay, I accept this position. But that confidence of that is quite variable. So I mean, it's based on weak evidence, but I need to move forward and make a decision. Or, you know, I'm really sure that, you know, that large nail in your hand is causing you the pain in your hand. Clinical correlation required, you know, but not everything is so towards either end of the spectrum. Most of it occurs in that big middle area where, like, there's a lot of uncertainty here and we're trying to minimize it and do the best job possible, but we do and we can make decisions with limited information. And like I said, the uncertainty sort of thing is something that I think most emergency physicians and clinicians are more comfortable with than maybe other people. All right, it's time for tool number 6. Oh, this is more than a handful now. We're up to 6. So this is about the evidence. Now, the evidence for a claim must be reliable, comprehensive, and sufficient. And I might add a friendly amendment there as proportional to the claim being made. So you've got 3 parts to that. So what do you mean by reliable?
So with reliable, I've broken that down to 2 parts. One is how the evidence was collected, and the other would be the source. So how the evidence was collected, is it an anecdote? Is it a meta-analysis? Is it the source? Is it coming from a reliable peer-reviewed journal? Is it coming from a random YouTube video?
Or some skeptical blogger like myself.
Right. Those things that you definitely have to be skeptical of.
Yes, and you should. And I encourage people to always be skeptical, even of stuff that I put out.
But all evidence is not created equal. So what we want to do is consider each piece of the puzzle for how we know that piece was collected and where that piece is coming from, because some pieces are more reliable than others.
So you're looking at validating, like probing that claim, you know, for, you know, is it reliable, but is it a valid, like, does it have some validity to it as well? What do you mean by comprehensive though?
Comprehensive refers to the body of evidence. This is basically, I like to use the puzzle analogy, where each piece of evidence is like a piece of a puzzle. And so when you put the pieces together as best we can, based on the pieces that we currently have and our ability to put them together, they form the body of evidence. And so based on the body of evidence, the comprehensiveness of the evidence, what does it tell us? The breaking this rule would be cherry picking, for example. And often cherry picking is because we're not being honest with ourselves. So it goes back to objectivity. But you know, you can cherry pick evidence to make nearly any claim that you want to make. The question is, what does the body of evidence say?
So that would be similar to the Texas sharpshooter fallacy as well, where you look for the evidence that you want to find. And then you go up to the barn and you draw a circle around where you shot and say, see, we always hit the bullseye. So that cherry picking and Texas sharpshooter logical fallacy. And in the SGM critical appraisals, near the end of the critical appraisal, once we've looked at the actual trial or study that we're appraising, we will take a step back and say, well, how are you going to clinically apply this information? Given the background information, where does this one publication fit in to the whole area of publication in this specific issue? And so I think that's really important, because we rarely should change practice based on one study or one clinical trial. It needs to be taken place in the context of the information that we have on the subject as a whole.
Yeah, it's one of the dangers of the single study syndrome, where you pick a single study and the question is, how does that study fit into everything else? As a science educator, and probably not in line with a lot of other science educators, in that I don't necessarily think it's my job to teach my students how to read primary literature. It's really difficult to read primary literature. I'm a prairie ecologist. I studied fire ecology on the Great Plains in succession in ecosystems in Iowa.
So you're going to have to back that up a bit. You were talking really fast. I didn't pick up some of that. You're a fireologist?
Fire ecologist.
Fire ecologist. Okay. I was like, fireologist? A fireist? What?
No, I started fires. It was really fun.
Yeah. No. So explain that. You study the nature of fires and how they impact the environment?
Yeah. So this was specifically on the Great Plains. Studied how the role of fire in maintaining prairies.
Okay, maintaining the ecosystem.
Yeah, and things like how often fires occur, the frequency and severity of fires, the effect on biodiversity of the plant communities. I mean, the point is, like, if you tried to read fire ecology literature, if I tried to read, right, it's, we talk to other nerds in our area, and that's great, but we each have our own language and our own methodologies and our own ability to talk to each other using primary literature. It's dangerous to try and convince the general public that they can just go to the primary literature for any general question that they have, because what they'll do is they'll go to Google Scholar, like they go to Google and they'll just type something in and it leads them to something. And then that something is a study. It looks scientific and they think it supports what they already believe, but they don't not only understand it, but they don't understand how it fits into everything else.
Yeah, the topic area, and then specifically how to critically appraise that scientific publication. Just because it's published doesn't mean it's necessarily true or valid or accurate. Each claim, if supported with, you know, a publication, let's say, that publication then needs to take a dive into it and probe it for its validity. I mean, it has layers. It's like an onion or an ogre. You know, it grows hair and makes people cry. No, everybody loves parfaits, but you know, it has layers. And so you got to dig down deeper into that when you're being comprehensive.
On a much lighter level with comprehensiveness, I have this meme that I show students where it's about water and it says things like 100% of serial killers have admitted to drinking water. And toxic pesticides are synthesized using water, and all drownings are because of water. If you wanted to cherry pick bits of evidence to try and make the case that water is somehow dangerous, you can. but it misses the bigger picture, which is that if we didn't have liquid water, we wouldn't be able to be alive. And so don't cherry pick. What does the body of evidence say?
All right. And the third component of that is to be sufficient. So what does it mean to be sufficient? What is sufficient evidence?
Well, it depends. It's always complicated.
That's my evidence-based medicine answer. I'm feeling such a synchronicity with you right now, Melanie. But yes, it all depends.
Oh, and people tend to hate that answer. I don't understand why.
Because they want an answer. They want a definitive answer and move forward and not, like, it takes that mental effort to think and go, yeah, it does depend. What are the variables that will inform my decision on this? And what feeds into that decision? And it does depend. I'm always explaining this in the medical world as it takes place in a context. So what's the context? This one piece of information isn't going to dictate my care. I need to consider it comprehensively within the patient's experience, my clinical judgment, and then this literature is going to inform my care, guide my care, not rule my care.
So part of sufficiency, I would say, is actually the proportionality that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah. So that's where the proportionality comes into it.
Yeah. It's the, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
Thank you, Sagan.
Exactly. Anecdotes aren't ever sufficient. Appeals to authority aren't ever sufficient. So with sufficiency, the question is proportioning the claim to the evidence that we have.
Yeah, and we've seen this recently with the claim that vitamin C could cure sepsis. Sepsis is a complex disease state that's life-threatening, has a high degree of mortality and morbidity. And so a claim that vitamin C or a vitamin C cocktail, in this case, that included thiamine and hydrocortisone, could cure sepsis, that's extraordinary. And I would need really good evidence to be accepting that claim and go, hey, yeah, okay. Because of course, I want to cure sepsis. I want to save people's lives. I want to minimize suffering. I mean, I always say that most of us who are at our medical school interview, when asked, why do you want to become a doctor? It's because I want to help people. So of course, if vitamin C could cure sepsis, sign me up. But the evidence that was put forward to support that claim was a observational, small, single center before after study. And many of us skeptics were, okay, that's interesting. Let's see if in a properly powered randomized control trial, this hypothesis is demonstrated to be quote unquote true. And the studies were done and did not support the original observation. So that's what you mean by sufficient. I get a little bit deeper into the weeds with my nerdy friends, you know, over p-values and stuff like that, saying, you know, I don't want to dichotomize into a study as quote negative or quote positive, based on some arbitrarily low bar, a p-value of 0.05, to make that claim. You know, oh, look, the p-value is 0.049. Spike the ball, high five everybody. Woohoo, we're getting published. This is true compared to 0.051. Okay, I guess we got to redo the experiment, throw it under the bottom of the desk drawer. We're never getting published. You know, the publication bias comes up. I think we should be raising the bar. And I agree with my good friend, Simon Carley, over at St. Emblin's, especially during this global pandemic, that we should be setting our, not expectations, but we should be raising the level of evidence required to accept a claim. And this whole idea of this 0.05 and it's true or not true based on one data point like that is really not appreciating the nuance of science and certainly medical care. Medical care is very complex, and yeah, a p-value is not the answer. I think it's not sufficient, just to get back to what you were saying. It's not sufficient, at least for me.
It's some of what I heard in there, because I can imagine the people that would really want the claim to be true that vitamin C could cure sepsis would be based on things like maybe people who have a bias against big pharma, or maybe have a bias towards natural remedies. And so that's where objectivity again comes in, because when we want these claims to be true, then our standard of evidence changes.
And then we see people personally identify and put their professional sort of name out there and say it's attached to that. And I don't want to, you know, beat up on vitamin C and stuff like that, because again, positive skepticism, but we've seen this with other things like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin and other vitamin D when it comes to COVID. Sure, it would be great if these older medications that get repurposed did have clinical efficacy, but when tested in properly designed studies, there isn't a lot of high quality, or there isn't high quality evidence to support that position. So if you're being objective and you haven't wrapped up your persona into it, then you accept the null hypothesis, and that's okay. You know, having a study, this is another sort of thing, you're going to make me think about so many things I want to talk about, but we should be asking the right questions and using the right methodology to answer those questions. And when we get the answer back, no matter what the answer is, whether this study supported superiority of the intervention or whether it did not, and so we accept the null hypothesis, both of those things to me are equal, because you asked a good question that was clinically relevant, you performed the study correctly, like you had good high quality methods, and you got an answer. Great, super. Question asked, question answered with regards to that. And we see this in publication bias. And a good friend of mine, Justin Morgenstern, you know, talks about when we submit our studies to be published, especially in high impact journals, we should submit them in advance, sort of like trial registries. But it goes one step beyond the trial registry. You submit your protocol and your question to the journal. And they look at going, okay, is this an important question? Are they asking a clinically relevant question? Does this have a patient-oriented outcome as its primary outcome? And have they designed the trial correctly to answer the question? And if the answer is yes, then we agree to publish it, regardless of what your results were. And then, of course, you get your results and you put them forward. And as long as, you know, you've followed what you said you were going to follow, because we've seen people change their primary outcomes and secondary outcomes and those types of things in trial registries. As long as you followed what you said you were going to do and present that, to me, it doesn't matter as much. I'm more interested in the question you were asking and the methods you put forward to answer the question, not so much the answer to the question. Because whether it be it did support your hypothesis or it doesn't, so you're going to accept the null hypothesis, that's enough for me. That should be out there. That should be published.
Spoken like a true skeptic, the process is more important than the conclusion.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. As soon as we attach our identity to a conclusion, though, it gets, we're not as objective about it.
No. And we really have to guard. I have to guard against that. I think we all, of course, have biases, and we've got to make sure that we're trying to stay objective as possible.
Yeah, I'm kind of chuckling here because when I teach my students about it, we go through biases, et cetera, and it is so much easier to see it in other people than it is to see it in ourselves, or especially in people we disagree with. And so, like, if you want to start by practice by seeing it in other people, don't call them out on it because that's not necessarily the best practice, but start by learning to recognize biases, then turn it inward. The goal is evaluating your own biases. Because it's so much easier to recognize when other people aren't being honest with themselves than it is when you're not. But if you think you're immune, you're just lying to yourself even more.
Well, we've got all the way to the seventh and final tool, and that's replicability. Evidence for a claim should be able to be repeated. And we have this reproducibility crisis in science. We'll often see one and done. In addition, subgroup findings that look interesting and should be considered hypothesis generating are rarely ever attempted to be confirmed. And in the few times that they are investigated, they often fail to confirm the original hypothesis. So we need to reproduce. We need to have replicability in science.
This is a really hard one because, again, like we're talking about the process of science, the one and done's, there's less emphasis placed on reproducing findings. So my concern mostly is for the average person. I'm trying to teach the average person how to evaluate claims. And so for them, again, going to the literature and looking for an answer to a question, and you could find a study that supports your claim, and then you might think, well, see, it's scientific, it's supported. So with reproducibility, we're really talking about how robust the conclusion is. So the idea is nature is consistent. So whatever our results should point to the same conclusion. If it doesn't, then we've done something wrong. This tool protects against error, fraud, and coincidence. So, you know, sometimes people make mistakes, but when we do it again, we realize that we made an error. Fraud is a bit harder to find, but, you know, we eventually can. Cleaning up after those messes can be quite challenging, as, you know, you're wearing your t-shirt that vaccines cause adults. You know, we're still trying to clean up after Wakefield's mess. His fraudulent study linking the MMR vaccine to autism. But from my perspective, I'm trying to teach my students how to evaluate claims. One of the things that I teach them is that as a non-expert in any area, the consensus of experts in that area is probably the most reliable source of knowledge. And that can take many forms. It can be the actual consensus of the experts. It could be the consensus of the literature. So maybe it's a meta-analysis. Maybe it's the position of the American Medical Association. An example would be with climate change. So climate change isn't based on a single study. It's based on multiple lines of evidence. Like, how do we know that the climate is changing? Well, we have observed temperature data. We have atmospheric temperature data. We have ocean temperature data. We have increased ocean levels. We have glaciers melting. We have earlier spring blooming. We have different migration patterns. We have later fall senescence of trees, for example. We have all these different lines of evidence that point to the same conclusion that the climate is changing. So we have that conclusion then is more robust. So the idea here basically is that we should have more evidence than a single study to support a conclusion. And as always, we should proportion our acceptance of a conclusion to the available evidence. And the more evidence that we have, the more robust that conclusion.
And you made a comment about consensus and, you know, what the American Medical Association may say. And that's not necessarily an appeal to authority. If they are experts, they are experts in that area. However, that doesn't make it true. And being an Uber nerd, I always take it one step farther and say, well, this is what the AMA says, but I'm more interested in the evidence that supports what they say than who or what organization is saying it, because it could or could not be correct or accurate and stuff like that. And I understand that you're teaching at a college level, and this is the one science course that they have to take. And so, of course, with, you know, an idea of what's the probability that this consensus of experts or the, you know, this organization is more likely or less likely to be true, it's more likely to be correct. I understand that, but I take it one step further because I'm into that critical appraisal part in my career where I'm looking at, okay, yes, you know, these organizations are made by individuals like me who are flawed and have biases. So what evidence did they use to come up with this consensus, and how reliable is that evidence? So I hope I'm just nudging or pushing back just a little bit on that.
Point taken, and I totally understand where you're coming from. I like to say that science has experts, not authorities. Let me come back to like the AMA. I would not be in a position to evaluate the evidence the AMA puts forward
for some disease condition, for high blood pressure or diabetes or cholesterol.
Yeah. I mean, I have the humility to recognize my own limits. So if the AMA has a position, and especially if that position is also in line with the other institutions and the journals, et cetera, then I'm just, honestly, I'm going to take their word for it and assume that that's the best the experts can come with at this point. I mean, it would be like, the U.S. Forest Service's position on, prescribed burning in longleaf pine forests.
Oh, yeah, that's something I'm really up to date on. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, we all subscribe to that journal of fire, healthy burning of fires for whatever ecological reason. Yeah, no, I'm waiting by the mailbox every month for that journal to come in.
You know, it's a page turner.
Is it available electronically? Yeah, no, but I get what you're saying, and I hope that this comes across the right way to people that are listening. You know, there's people who are non-experts outside the field who should defer and have the humility to say, yeah, okay. yeah, I accept that. And then there's people within that space who should be challenging experts and leaders and organizations on their positions to make sure they're the best positions possible. And so that, I'm always saying that patients, what an ultimate goal of the SGEM is that patients get the best care based on the best evidence. And so pushing that. And as an expert in some areas, certainly there's more things that I'm not expert at than the things that I have an expertise at. I welcome questions. I welcome criticism. I welcome feedback. And I encourage people not to trust me and to ask questions and be skeptical.
That actually, you raise a really important point. And I think a lot of people hear consensus and they just think that it's like a general agreement where, we could agree that cats make the best pets, right?
I think we've covered this territory.
Exactly, but we agree, and so it must be true. when scientists come to consensus, though, I mean, you and I both know scientists don't necessarily like to agree. They built a career off of trying to get as close to the truth as they can, and they do so by trying to find errors in each other's reasoning and methodology and so on. And so when experts have reached consensus, it actually is something really special. And it's I'm actually trusting the process that in that area, they have done exactly what you just said, which is they've held each other to account. They've argued over all of these things. And if they've come to some base level that they agree on, I am not going to do any better than what you all did.
Wow, we got through the 7 items of your floater acronym. Woohoo! But I always like to leave an open-ended question at the end. So is there anything else you want to say about your floater initiative, thinking in power in general, skepticism, critical appraisal? The floor is yours.
Wow, open-ended questions. So I would say about floater, it is an overwhelming toolkit. When I give it to my students, I present it early in the semester and I give them all semester to practice. I build on it all semester and quizzes, case studies, assignments, exams, all of these are opportunities to practice because this is not something that comes naturally. The goal is at the end of all this kind of practice that they are able to start to practice on their own. So if this is brand new, for example, to students, if you're an educator, or if it's new to you thinking this way, don't get discouraged that, practice makes perfect. So keep at it. We're all just trying to do better than we did before. With Thinking is Power, my hope with Thinking is Power is that I've set up the website so that it has 3 major sections. One of them is what I call foundations, and it is the background skills, the critical thinking, information literacy, and science literacy skills that I hope my students get from the course. So it's the foundational skills. It's also in the process of being built, so more will be added. I then have a topics section. And so that's where I apply those skills to different topics. So for example, I've got articles on homeopathy or psychics, alternative medicine in general, ghosts. And then there's a section on for educators. And that's where I have various assignments and case studies, et cetera, that I use in my class for other educators who are interested in teaching this way. And if you want to follow me on social media.
And you should.
Thank you. At Thinking Powers on Facebook and on Twitter. And I try to do something at least every day, your little critical thinking tidbit for the day.
Wow. You know, this has been the longest episode of the SGEM that I've ever done. And the time just flew by. Epic information, great quality, super guest. The episode that I'm working on is always my favorite episode. So this is my favorite episode, but it's also the longest episode. We had a number of quotes. And so I was thinking how to finish this up with a really good quote. And so after listening to you and getting to meet you and know you in real life, even though we're doing this electronically, you know what quote came to me?
I'm dying to know.
It's not Feynman.
Is it Sagan?
It's not Sagan.
Is it from Star Trek?
No, it's not from Star Trek either, but good guess. And now I'm starting to think of a good Star Trek quote because they're all good quotes. No, it's from Marie Curie.
Oh.
Yes. So she was asked by a journalist at one point in time how it felt to be married to a genius. You know, because her husband had won the Nobel Prize. And you know what her answer was?
I can't wait to hear.
I don't know. You can ask my husband. And after spending 2 hours doing this with you, and I know your husband is this conductor and this talented individual, you know, my question to you would be, hey, what's it feel like to be married to such a wonderful, amazing person? And you can go, I don't know, ask my husband.
You can ask him.
Yeah. So that's the quote that came to mind, because I think you are amazing. This has been fabulous. You have invigorated my day, my week, and I can't wait to put this podcast up.
Oh, I am so happy to have finally met you. I have really appreciated interacting with you on Twitter and your support. And you bring such a fun energy to skepticism. And I'm just humbled to be here. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. The SGEM will be back next episode doing a structured critical appraisal of a recent publication, trying to cut that knowledge translation window down from over 10 years down to less than 1 year. Using the power of social media, so patients get the best care based on the best evidence. Melanie, can you do me the honor of giving the SGEM tagline?
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.